The pipeline building boom across Pennsylvania has a lot of people thinking about safety, from deciding where underground pipelines should be placed.
Let's look at a 100-mile-wide pathway. What's the most protective of the environment and human health path you can take?
To planning for a worst-case scenario.
Now we have a big cloud that may be a mile wide laying on the ground. Is going to be one hell of a boom.
I'm Carol Holsapple. This week on the Allegheny Front, we're taking a closer look at pipelines, including the fatality rate of workers on the job building them.
In 2016, that was 3.6 times the national average for the average American worker. It has reached highs of 7 times.
Those stories about pipelines and more coming up on the Allegheny Front. Stay with us. Time is running out on the Farm Bill, a massive $860 billion piece of legislation that's negotiated every 5 years. The current bill expires September 30th. The Allegheny Front's Julie Grant reports on what this might mean for Pennsylvania farmers.
House and Senate negotiations on the Farm Bill are reportedly being held up by new work requirements in the House version for people who get food benefits. Farm programs are caught in the crosshairs. Steve Groff farms corn, tomatoes, and squash in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania. He's confident that even if Congress fails to agree on the Farm Bill by Sunday, programs like crop insurance will continue to be funded.
So I don't see this as a crisis looming. I see it more as an impetus to let's get this deal done. Let's update it and move on.
If there is no Farm Bill agreement this week, the Pennsylvania Farm Bureau also expects a program to protect dairy prices to be funded at least until the end of the year, though some conservation programs would not get new funding. Pennsylvania farmers received more than $40 million for conservation projects last year. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Julie Grant.
When it opens later this month, the Mariner East pipeline will carry natural gas liquids through some of the most densely populated parts of the state. But for companies that own pipelines like the Mariner East and the one that recently exploded in Beaver County, there are few regulations as to where these pipelines can be built. As part of a State Impact Pennsylvania series, the Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier reports some want to change that.
Chuck Belzik is in his backyard, pointing through some trees down a hill.
So you can kind of see the top of the black right there, way at the end of the tree line down there, just probably, 50 yards or so.
He's pointing to a wall behind his house in Center Township, Beaver County. Beyond that wall is the Revolution Pipeline, a 24-inch gathering line owned by Energy Transfer Partners. Not far from where we're standing, it blew up in early September. Belzik said it sounded like a bomb went off.
You know, something that you don't ever want to hear when you, in your lifetime. It shook the whole neighborhood. It really did.
The pipeline had only been online for a week when officials believe a landslide caused by heavy rains led to the explosion. The fire destroyed a neighbor's home, but no one was hurt. Belzik said he didn't like that the pipeline was built so close to his house.
It is, but I mean, what are you going to do? I mean, this is where you live, and you know, if we owned the property, it might have been a different story. You know, we had no say-so what goes on.
It turns out no one, no federal, state, or local government, has much of a say-so in where pipelines like this one can go. That's because of a hole in the patchwork of federal and state regulations that oversee pipeline construction. A pipeline route that crosses state lines has to get federal approval. But the Revolution doesn't cross state lines. It only carries gas from Butler County to Washington County. For those Pennsylvania-only pipelines, state regulations only come into play when the route crosses a stream or wetland. The Pennsylvania Public Utility Commission is the state's main regulator for pipelines and oversees things like safety and construction standards. But it says state law doesn't allow it to oversee pipeline siting. Andrew Place, the vice chairman of the commission, thinks the PUC, or some state agency, should have the power to do that, just like it does with overhead power lines.
From my perspective, my individual perspective, I don't draw a distinction.
He says this would give more say to local communities and allow the state to take a more global look at pipeline routes, so that it can minimize their impacts.
You can look at these broader questions. All right, let's look at a 100-mile-wide pathway. What's the most protective of the environment and human health path you can take?
A bill introduced by State Senator Andrew Dinneman of suburban Philadelphia would give the PUC this ability. Dinneman said his concern grew out of constituent complaints that the Mariner East pipeline goes too close to schools, libraries, and houses in his district.
And because the state has no siting authority, the PUC essentially lets the pipeline be built wherever the company wants it to be built.
Dinneman said oversight from the PUC would allow the public to comment on projected pipeline routes and push the commission to implement stricter safety measures in densely populated areas.
Hopefully, by granting some siting authority, it will force the PUC to ask the questions they should be asking anyway.
But it's unclear how far this idea will go. Dinneman's bill remains stuck in committee. Dave Spiegelmeyer, president of the Marcellus Shale Coalition, an industry trade group, opposes the bill. He says pipeline companies try to keep their routes away from sensitive areas. Spiegelmeyer says natural gas brings economic benefits and has helped displace dirtier coal as a power source.
The benefits are extraordinary, and we can't find ways to slow its development. We should be encouraging its development.
Back in Beaver County, Chuck Belzik says even if there were more oversight over where pipelines can be built, he's not sure it would do much to keep them away from his neighborhood.
How far do you push that? You know, are you going to win the battle in the long run? And all it's going to do is just cost you time and money. That's the bottom line. I mean, how do you fight that?
Whether he likes it or not, he says he's got to live with the pipeline behind his house. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Reed Frazier.
President Trump is committed to rolling back regulations.
My administration has canceled or delayed over 1,500 planned regulatory actions or assaults, more than any president in the history of the United States.
But he's being met with resistance in court. And when it comes to the environment, that resistance is often winning. That's coming up on the Allegheny Front. Stay tuned. The September explosion of the natural gas pipeline in Beaver County was a shock for people living nearby. And what about local emergency crews that had to respond? For State Impact Pennsylvania, 90.5 WESA's Amy Sisk looks at how first responders have prepared for a potential emergency as the Mariner East 2 pipeline nears completion.
Bob Rossetti drives this road in rural Westmoreland County all the time. It passes a lush valley, and a radio tower juts out of the ground in the distance. Today, the chief of the Forbes Road Volunteer Fire Department is in his engine, recollecting a gas pipeline explosion 2 years ago.
You know, the flames were way higher than the tower. You could not see the tower. The road here was all smoking. It had rained that morning, and it was pulling the steam up off the road.
The blast destroyed a home and severely burned a man. Now, the Mariner East 2 pipeline has gone in a couple miles north. Pipeline explosions are rare, but if one happens on that line, Rossetti will be among the first to respond again. Back in the fire hall, he says on one hand, he's prepared.
I'm very comfortable with the gas in the area because of the exposure and the training that we have to it.
On the other hand,
I would be lying to you if I did tell you that the propane does concern me very much, though. Yes, it does.
Mariner East 2 starts in Ohio and will carry propane, butane, and ethane in liquid form to Philadelphia. Those substances would turn into gas if they escape and stay low to the ground until they disperse. Rossetti envisions a major leak and a spark could lead to this worst-case scenario.
Now we have a big cloud that may be a mile wide laying on the ground. It's going to be one hell of a bill.
If a pipeline explodes, it often falls to the pipeline company to stop its flow of gas. That's according to Patrick Pauly, who recently retired from the State Fire Academy.
The fire department's not going to be able to do anything as far as mitigating that leak.
An explosion might be so big or hot that firefighters couldn't get close enough anyway. So their role is to manage the area around the incident.
Evacuation may be necessary depending on where it's at.
Along the road where the explosion happened in 2016, Rossetti describes how the day played out. His department helped residents flee and sprayed water on homes to prevent them from catching fire, while workers for pipeline operator Spectra Energy closed valves.
Once they shut that down, it went from looking like a blowtorch, it went to what we would describe as looking like a candle flickering.
With the new pipeline coming through, Rossetti and others from his department attended a training hosted by Energy Transfer Partners. The company says more than 2,000 first responders have participated in trainings for its Mariner pipelines. A spokesperson says the company, quote, literally hired the guy who wrote the book on pipeline emergencies to lead many of its Mariner East 2 sessions. That's consultant Gregory Knoll. He writes in an email that he showed responders how to size up an incident. Is the gas leaking or is it on fire? Is the incident getting bigger? And do responders know the full scope of the problem? Knoll is working with the State Fire Academy and operators to streamline the variety of pipeline trainings available to first responders in Pennsylvania. Pauly heads up that effort.
Rather than several operating companies offering very similar, almost identical programs, if we could get to one specific or two specific programs, then, you know, we might eliminate some duplication.
In Beaver County, several new pipelines are keeping Director of Emergency Services Eric Brewer busy attending trainings, like on this September day.
Just came out of it about 10 minutes ago.
The meeting for a proposed Shell pipeline was scheduled coincidentally for the day after a section of a different pipeline blew up in the county. Energy Transfer Partners, the same company building Mariner East 2, owns that line. No one was injured, but it burned a home and knocked down power lines. Brewer's advice to first responders along Mariner East 2 is simple.
Meet with the company beforehand. Get with them, get some good contact numbers.
He says that step is key so that a catastrophe isn't the first time they meet. Amy Sisk, State Impact Pennsylvania.
There's another safety issue to consider when we're talking about pipelines, the safety of the workers who build and maintain them. That's the subject of a piece by journalist Antonia Yuhas in the latest issue of Pacific Standard magazine. It's called Death on the Dakota Access, an investigation into the deadly business of building oil and gas pipelines. You'll remember Dakota Access is the almost 1,200-mile underground crude oil pipeline that begins in the Bakken Shale region of North Dakota and ends in Illinois. The final stage of its construction was the cause of mass protests and a standoff between Native American and other activists and law enforcement. The pipeline is owned by Energy Transfer Partners, which also owns the natural gas pipeline that exploded in Beaver County. I recently spoke with Antonia Yuhas. Through your investigation and reporting, you found that oil and gas pipeline workers had a higher fatality rate than the average American worker. Tell me about the numbers and where the data came from.
When I discovered that one worker, Nicholas Janicich, had died building the Dakota Access Pipeline, and I saw a brief report of it by the North Dakota Associated Press, I decided to look more deeply into what caused his death and then to ask this question of overall safety and security. What I found out was that the Bureau of Labor Statistics, which publishes fatality rate data for, you know, it's what most people use. It's the standard set of information that we use for understanding the fatality rates associated with different industries in the United States. They only started counting deaths in oil and natural gas pipeline construction or reporting them in 2003, and that they have never produced publicly a fatality rate for oil and natural gas pipeline construction. So I spoke with Bureau of Labor Statistics and tried to, you know, understand why they hadn't run this information, and they didn't really have an answer for me, and they weren't planning on doing it, and I couldn't convince them to do it, so I decided to do it myself. And crunching the numbers, I came up with this, you know, unique data set, and so as not to compare apples to oranges, I created, using the same model, and again, using Bureau of Labor Statistics data, both a fatality rate for oil and gas pipeline construction workers and a national fatality rate with which to compare it. And what I came up with is oil and gas pipeline construction workers having a fatality rate in 2016 that was 3.6 times the national average for the average American worker, and that it has reached highs of 7 times the average rate, and since 2003 has averaged 4.3 times the fatality rate for the average American worker.
You mentioned the worker who died during the Dakota Access Pipeline construction, Nicholas Janicich, and another worker who died during the construction of that pipeline. Can you tell me a little bit about what happened to them?
Janicich's death, I did a Freedom of Information Act request, interviewed a sheriff and other local parties, but there are no witnesses to his death. Janicich was working alone, essentially, out near where Dakota Access Pipeline, where it starts. And he was working at the very tail end of pipeline construction. And he, in fact, had never worked on pipeline construction before. He was only 3 weeks into the job. And he was driving a tractor. So pipe was already in the ground. The earth was returned above it. And he was retilling the land using something called a ripper to allow vegetation to grow there again. And he was, as I uncovered, is very typical in this industry, a subcontractor to a subcontractor to a subcontractor to a subcontractor. The tractor he was working on had been altered. It jammed. He got out to fix it himself, jammed a crowbar into the ripper, and these scythe-like blades that are used to till the ground dislodged and struck him in the skull. He made his way back into the tractor and was randomly found by his foreman, who happened to be driving another worker to another tractor site, and he died from a skull fracture less than 24 hours after being injured. And just 3 days later, at the other end of the pipeline in Illinois, another worker, Troy Dolan, was also killed, and his death had not been reported as associated with the Dakota Access Pipeline until I filed a Freedom of Information Act request and started digging. And his was, you know, just exceptionally avoidable. He had been suffering from heat stroke all day, moving heavy equipment around. He seemed to have sought out shade under a lowboy truck, which is used to haul these massive pieces of equipment. And he must have fallen asleep or potentially passed out. And the driver of the truck moved the truck, not knowing he was under it, and crushed him to death, killing him.
Who is looking out for these workers? What are the regulations?
Even though oil and gas extraction and pipeline construction are considered part of the mining sector by the federal government, they are not subject to the more stringent Mining Health and Safety Act, which requires inspections of sites, whether or not there's been an incident, whether or not there's been a reported problem, a death or an injury. Even though oil and natural gas extraction and pipeline construction have among the highest fatality rates in the nation, both sectors fall under, instead of mining, they fall under the regular OSHA Act, Occupational Safety and Health Act, and it's less stringent safety requirements. So no mandatory inspections. And in fact, before Janicich's death, in the previous 6 months, OSHA had not inspected a single part of the Dakota Access Pipeline at all until he died. And one reason for that is how few OSHA inspectors there are. There's only 8 in the entire state of North Dakota. And the AFL-CIO has found that it would take OSHA 100 years in North Dakota to inspect every job site just once. And these sectors, oil and gas and pipeline construction, are considered low hazard industries, which means that they are subject to less stringent OSHA oversight. And that was already the condition going into the Trump administration. For example, right now, there is no OSHA administrator under the Trump administration. It has significantly lost staff, including inspectors. And the Trump administration has eliminated and failed to enforce a number of Obama-era regulations that were geared at making these sectors more safe, and also has rolled back reporting requirements, including what is posted on the Bureau of Labor Statistics website and what information needs to be made publicly available in terms of injuries and fatalities that is gathered from the companies.
is there a difference between building an oil pipeline like the Dakota Access Pipeline versus a gas transmission line like the ones we have here in Pennsylvania?
There is a difference, but not a significant difference. So basically, it's a standard set of procedures for how you build a pipe, regardless of what's going to pass through it. There are different regulations in terms of how deep the pipe needs to be in the ground, thickness of the pipe, but basically in terms of the process of building, it's the same. I also found that in pipeline construction, and this is very important to Pennsylvania, compared to the previous decade, pipelines built since 2010 carrying oil and other hazardous liquids are more than twice as likely to suffer incidents, and those carrying natural gas are over 5 times more disaster prone. And that impacts, of course, both the workers whose job it is to install it, to maintain it, even more importantly, and the people who live near those pipelines. And so we are seeing a rash of pipeline explosions recently, particularly pipelines carrying natural gas, that are both suffering failures because they're too old and suffering failures because they're too new.
Antonia Juhas's article, Death on the Dakota Access, an investigation into the deadly business of building oil and gas pipelines, appears in the latest issue of Pacific Standard magazine. There's a link and more of our conversation at AlleghenyFront.org. This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapple. The Trump administration is holding hearings across the country on a rule to roll back Obama-era vehicle emission standards. State Impact Pennsylvania's Amy Sisk reports from a hearing in Pittsburgh.
New standards to improve gas mileage and reduce tailpipe emissions through 2025 took effect under the Obama administration. But President Trump's Environmental Protection Agency and the Department of Transportation have proposed freezing them at 2020 levels and revoking states' abilities to set their own limits. Many members of the public who testified opposed that idea. Person after person, from city officials to the American Lung Association and the Environmental Defense Fund, spoke against it. Ken Kimmel is with the Union of Concerned Scientists.
These car standards that are in place are working really well. They're saving people money at the pump. They're cutting down on our dependence upon burning oil. And they are cutting, in a significant way, our greenhouse gas emissions.
The Trump administration says newer cars are safer, and the proposal will make them more affordable, which in turn will reduce crash fatalities. Amy Sisk, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
The Trump administration is attempting to roll back dozens of environmental regulations, including vehicle emission standards, which we just heard about, a methane rule to curb leaks from oil and gas operations on public lands, and the Waters of the U.S. rule, which helps define which bodies of water are protected under the Clean Water Act. But all of this is not happening without a fight. The Natural Resources Defense Council is a group that's taken on the administration 25 times in court over these rollbacks, and won 21. For our podcast, Trump on Earth, the Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier spoke with the NRDC's chief counsel, Mitch Bernard, about what's ahead.
Given that the Trump administration has been very sort of successful in getting a lot of its judicial appointments made to date, what happens when the judiciary starts to absorb a lot of these appointments? Does it make it harder for you to kind of prove your case before these federal judges?
That's a very good question, and we'll see. I worry about it, but less than many other people do. If a judge is qualified to sit on the bench, by which I mean he or she is rigorous and independent and open-minded, then I think we're going to get a fair shot. If that judge is a conservative on various issues, or is a Republican, or appointed by a Republican administration, or confirmed by a Republican Senate, that doesn't worry me very much. As you move up in the system, in the circuit courts of appeal, and especially the Supreme Court, ideology tends to matter more. Those courts are making law. They're announcing law. They're not just applying it. The other thing to remember is that NRDC's cases mostly are law enforcement cases. We're holding people, either the government or a private polluter, accountable to the law. There's nothing about that endeavor that should turn off a conservative judge, even if that judge is not a big fan of NRDC.
I mean, the sort of broader question may be, is this a good system for deciding how to regulate the environment? I mean, it's, you know, a lot of people don't like the litigiousness of our society. You know, that's just a general sort of overlay. And a lot of the work of the government is being, you know, depending on how you look at it, held up or held back by these lawsuits. So
I would say thank goodness for that. Without the rule of law, where would we be? You know, it's one of the things that separates us from other countries, other forms of government. And it's part of what keeps us from descending into a kind of, to me, a kind of chaos or autocracy. And then when people don't obey the law, that's when you turn to the courts. Because without enforcement, these laws are just statements. They don't have the meaning they're intended to have in the real world.
Let's say there's another president who gets elected in 2020 who has different opinions about regulations than this one. How easy will it be for them to sort of go back on some of the Trump administration's rollbacks or, you know, the rules that they're creating that are more generous to industry? How hard will it be for them to sort of reverse course on some of these laws?
Well, if they do it correctly, it's not going to be so easy. It's going to take time because, as I said, you have to go through the proper procedures. First of all, you have to decide what you think is the right thing to do and what Trump initiatives you really can't live with or want to refine or revise in some way. And then you have to go through a sometimes lengthy process to elicit public comment and consider that comment. And then you have to put together a factual record and then see where that leads you. So if you do it correctly, then at the very least, it will take time. To the extent the Trump administration succeeds in ripping up sound and critical environmental and human health protections, it's going to take years to repair that damage, even after a new president is elected who wishes to do that.
So in a way, even if they lose 80% of their court cases, they're sort of succeeding in gumming up the works for whoever comes in next.
Well, they're succeeding in part. They've been stymied a lot. They've wanted to change a lot of things that they have not yet been permitted to change. But they do get some things through, and they certainly have big plans. When you look at the Waters of the United States rule or the Clean Power Plan, I mean, these are huge and hugely significant areas of regulation that, if they get their way, will be upended. Undoing that kind of damage will take a lot of time and effort.
Mitch Bernard is lead counsel for the Natural Resources Defense Council. He spoke with the Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier for our podcast, Trump on Earth. You can hear more of that conversation at trumponearth.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for joining us on the Allegheny Front. Kathy Naur is the executive producer of our show. I'm Carol Holsapple.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments, the Pittsburgh Foundation, and the Park Foundation. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports our coverage of conservation. State Impact Pennsylvania is a collaboration among the Allegheny Front, WESA, WITF, and WHYY to cover the Commonwealth's energy economy.